This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. William Schwab, is a trauma surgeon who sees the consequences of urban violence. He treats several hundred gunshot victims a year. Surgeons from around the world now come to him to learn how to treat gun wounds. Dr. Schwab is the chief of traumatology and surgical critical care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System in Philadelphia. He considers gun injuries an epidemic that is preventable. So along with Dr. Therese Richmond, who will join us a little later, Schwab founded the Firearm Injury Center at Penn, whose mission is to create safer communities through the systematic reduction of firearm injuries. What were the kinds of injuries that you were seeing that led you to create the Firearm Injury Center?
What we were seeing is an ever-increasing number of complex multiple gunshot wounds in the youth of Philadelphia. And we decided together as a team that we needed to look at the root causes of this. Rather than just patching these young, generally men up and turning them back into their environment, we really decided that what we needed to do is find why this was happening, see if we could analyze that, and intervene beyond just physical surgery or physical medicine, and put people back into the community.
Have the gun injuries that you're treating changed in the years that you've been treating gun injuries as guns and bullets have changed?
Yes. They changed drastically, actually, in the late 1980s. You may not remember, but in the mid-1980s, the 9mm semi-automatic pistol was made commercially available to citizens of the United States. They could buy that gun. That gun is a pistol. It's different than a revolver. It can fire multiple bullets in a very, very short time span. It led to multiple bullets striking the human body. Prior to that, it was gunshots weren't rare in the United States, but in fact, most of the time, someone was shot once. And starting in about 1988 and through now, what we've seen is an ever-increasing number of bullet holes, organs injured, and when one looks scientifically, there is very, very good data and experience to say the more number of times you're shot, the more number of organs injured, the higher your death rate. So more complex wounding, more complex sequelae, and a higher death rate because of the weaponry.
And how does that affect how you treat a patient? You know, if they have one gun wound, you could focus on that wound, but if they have several bullet holes, how does that affect the treatment?
Well, it drastically changes how you treat those injuries. And what's interesting is that the more times the human body is shot, the more tissue destruction, the more bleeding, the more shock, and the more physiologic consequence of all that. Something that's known as now is the lethal triad of death, which is a cold patient who's in shock, who's acidotic, and can't coagulate or stop their bleeding. So starting about 12 to 14 years ago, we had to look at a different way of doing surgery. We had to do it in an unconventional way. And we developed techniques that look at minimal acceptable care of each of those injuries, minimal acceptable care to stop bleeding, to prevent that lethal triad from spiraling down and leading to a quick death. The term we put on that is damage control. When one reads about what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan now, or one reads about things that are happening in the military around the world, one reads about damage control. Damage control is unconventional surgery where someone is dying from wounds, and all the surgery that is done when they are first encountered is stopping bleeding and saving life. And then resuscitating a patient and bringing them back a day or more later and fixing everything anatomically.
What would go wrong if you did it the other way around, if you tried to fix everything the first time around instead of doing damage control and then really fixing it a day later?
What happens is that the experience shows that people aren't able to tolerate long surgery. The hypothermia, the acidosis.
What's acidosis?
Acidosis. You and I live at a certain balance in our body between alkaline and acid. pH is what it's called scientifically. Our body requires a very normal range physiologically for all the cells to function. If it becomes too acid, there's too much acid around, then things don't work very well. The cells don't work. Cells don't make energy. cells don't utilize oxygen and glucose sugar so that you maintain energy support systems. And like a computer, it very quickly shuts down. Damage control is aimed at interrupting that spiral. And if we now have good evidence to say that if you stay and try to fix everything and prolong surgery, that in fact the death rate is higher.
I've interviewed people about injuries in Iraq. And what I'm hearing there about the improvised explosive device wounds sound kind of similar to what you're talking about, because those IEDs, you got multiple shrapnel wounds. So it's not just like one bullet to treat. So what are some of the connections between the kind of medicine you're doing in the city of Philadelphia and the kind of medicine being practiced in Iraq now?
Well, there's a lot of similarities. First and foremost, the type of wounds, whether it's multiple bullets from a pistol or one high muzzle velocity bullet wound from a military weapon or an IED, when the tissue destruction is extensive enough, the same problem with maintaining normal physiology occurs. So whether the person is an IED attack or explosion, a wound, what's going on in Iraq is pretty much exactly the same techniques that are being used as were being used in Philadelphia and the major cities in the United States in the last 10 or 12 years. Damage control is very prominent in the way individual surgeons are handling wounds in Iraq, as well as the mentality on the battlefield, which is that far forward surgeons will do a damage control procedure, stop bleeding, stop contamination in and around the body, and then what they will do is pack those open wounds and ship that patient back where they'll have definitive surgery hours or days later, exactly as the damage control that we described from Penn in 1992.
So does this mean that war medicine is learning from shootings in American cities and what the doctors are doing there? Has violence in American cities gotten to the point where the war doctors are learning from the urban doctors in America?
The answer is yes. And as a matter of fact, that may be a paradigm shift that's occurred in the last 15 years. War in the history of man has been the greatest stimulant to the advancements in medicine and surgery. And what happened in the late 1980s in many of our large urban areas in America, we saw an ever-increasing of these complex wounds from handguns. Surgeons had to adapt. Surgeons had to develop. Surgeons had to be imaginative and come up with new techniques that we found worked and saved people's lives. If you track back during that time and up to the present time, we've been training our surgical trainees, our fellows, on all these techniques, and they are, in fact, the military surgeons, the combat surgeons that are in Iraq using these techniques. The improvement in survival was so profound in the early 1990s, dealing with these gunshot wound victims, this terrible liability, that in fact the United States Armed Forces changed the war manual, that manual that directs most care on the battlefield, and added damage control as a principal technique to take care of these wounds. So I think the answer to the question is yes. These combat surgeons have learned from us, and now they're having wonderful successes with our combat soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Dr. Schwab, we've mentioned that you've trained doctors who have subsequently gone to Iraq and practiced combat medicine there. But I also know that doctors from countries around the world have come to your center to learn about how to treat gun wounds. Why do they need to come to your center, and why do they need to know more about guns? Is it because of increasing violence in their countries?
Well, when one looks at the need for surgeons in an emergency situation, and one looks at it globally, there's a number of areas where a surgeon's needed. Certainly combat surgeons, but also, interestingly, in response to the need for organizations like NATO, the United Nations, the International Red Cross, all those civilian relief medical organizations want physicians that know how to take care of wounds. Why? Because those organizations move in response to conflict. So about 15 years ago, a number of surgical leaders around the world got together and said, this is interesting. We have several countries in which the doctors and nurses are being mobilized to support those efforts, and they have no experience with treating wounds. And it was suggested that, in fact, that they come to the United States. So for about 10 years, we've had surgeons coming, and they spend time with us. For me, personally, it's been a way to take a terrible liability in American society and at least make it, to some degree, an asset. But what we've seen is a constant flow of physicians from the Asian Rim, from Australia, from New Zealand, and especially from the Scandinavian countries, who come with us for about a month. And in a month's time, they probably see more gunshot wounds and major injuries than they will see in three or four lifetimes in their current countries.
My guest is Dr. William Schwab, Chief of Traumatology and Surgical Critical Care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System and co-founder of the Firearm Injury Center at Penn. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Now, I think you served in the military in Vietnam. Do I have that right?
I was trained in the United States Navy during Vietnam, but I never went to Vietnam, the country.
Did you ever practice combat medicine?
I did. I trained in a large naval hospital on the East Coast. At that time, it was 1,900 beds, and I was one of the surgical house officers and eventually the surgical faculty that were receiving wounded soldiers back from Vietnam. In those days, as opposed to now, it would take 3 to 4 weeks to receive them back. Now it takes, as you well know, 4 to 5 days, sometimes less, to be back from Iraq. But we had a very, very large part of our practice was related to taking care of the delayed complications of wounding and to manage some of the more definitive surgeries and reconstruction of these young soldiers and sailors. And that's where I became interested in trauma surgery and in ballistics and in wounding.
Yeah, so what are some of the things you learned from combat medicine that you've applied to working in an American city?
There's a simple answer to that, and there's a complex answer. The simple answer is one of the first things that one had to learn in order to be a military surgeon is you had to learn ballistics. Ballistics isn't a part of the typical conventional medical education. But interestingly, my background in ballistics, because of my military background, really afforded me, if you would, the science of wounding and how it applies to medical care. So I felt very, very comfortable with that. The second thing that you had to learn to be a military physician, and it was taught to you as part of the standard curriculum of military surgery, was how to triage, how to make very, very important decisions about life and death and be comfortable with those with a minimal amount of data. And the scenarios that we were put in where you're the surgeon, you have a certain amount of resources, you have a certain number of operating rooms, you have a certain number of units of blood, and you're receiving 30 wounded soldiers. How do you sort those out between those that are dead, those that will die, no matter what you do, and those that you can help, and those that you don't need to do very much about? I think that set us up very well and set me very well to lead a civilian trauma surgeon, where many nights at the University of Pennsylvania, other places in this city, we're seeing literally 10, 12, 15 patients all coming in with a matter of minutes that need care. And it allows you to teach that. Again, not a conventional part of medicine as it is taught in our medical schools and in our training hospitals, but the military provided that for me.
What kind of flipped a switch for you to go just from practicing medicine to trying to practice prevention of violence, to set up a program about preventing the kind of violence that you end up treating?
The personal side of this is there is nothing more painful in my life than walking out of an operating room and telling a young mother or a father that his 16 or 17-year-old child is dead because of a gun wound. That experience, week after week, night after night, in the early 1990s, was so emotional, and is to this day, so emotional for me, that I had to turn to people that had skills and experience that I don't have and say, how can we stop this? I can patch him up. Surgeons can stop the bleeding. But this is a disease, this is a problem that goes well away from the operating room. And it just seemed like we were being overrun constantly with these young kids, these beautiful kids, and we needed to do something to find a way to break the cycle. And so we started, with Terry Richmond's help, we started the center, and the rest is history.
What are you trying to do that's different than what was done before to try to prevent violence?
Well, I think the most important thing is what we're trying to do, and what we tried to do in the early 1990s is to say to American medicine, to the American public, this is a public health problem. This is something that needs to be conquered. I mean, it's not exactly the same as cancer. It's not the same as an infectious disease, but this is violence. And violence should be able to be studied, and we should be able to find a way to lower the toll from violence or to identify early on those people that may enter into a violent situation or commit an act of violence.
So what's your approach? Are you looking for legislation? Are you talking to the gun lobby, working for gun control? Like, what's the focus?
The most important focus that I think could be identified right away is research. And only through legitimate research will we be able to identify the root causes of why people become violent. And at the same time, we have to have some short-term solutions to try to lower the toll and to try to live safer in a society that has chosen to live with guns. And I think you ought to ask her that.
Terry Richmond, what do you think?
That's my mantra, isn't it?
It is. That's why I used it.
Yes, I agree that obviously research is key. But, you know, I think the first thing and how we approach it differently, you actually in your question said, you know, do you talk to the gun lobby? You talk about gun control? No. Our goal as injury scientists is to decrease injury and death from gun violence. And by focusing on decreasing injury and death, we totally stay away from what's been very polarized in this country, pro-gun or anti-gun. So from a practical perspective, the first thing we want to do is to get people to talk to each other. So I could say, you could maybe be very pro-gun, but I could say, well, can't you agree with me that we want to decrease injury and death? Can we agree on that? Then let's think about how we can do that. People think, you can't stop this. I shoot you, it happens in the blink of an eye. It's not like I've had years and years and years of risk factors to develop cancer or heart disease, in a way. But in another way, you may have had years and years and years of risk factors that put you at risk for being shot. And it's simply, if you think about at-risk people in at-risk environments with hazardous objects, those three things come together in a point in time and an injury happens. If we go back and think about all those things that have to come together, I just have to interrupt one path in order to prevent that gun injury. That opens up a whole nother world of opportunities. It takes it away from pro-gun, anti-gun.
One last question. You've taken out a lot of bullets from a lot of wounds. What do you do with the bullets afterwards? Do people usually want them?
Actually, there's a chain of evidence that's required when one removes a bullet. And it's not like television or the old Westerns that we watched when we were kids when it was dropped into the metal bucket. In fact, what happens is that there's a very specific technique to remove a bullet or a bullet fragment. It is witnessed as it is passed from the surgeon to the circulating team in the operating room. It is labeled. There is a evidence chain. It is passed through hospital security and either to the Philadelphia or police or the FBI. It's a very, very strict procedure. Subsequently, when people come back and ask us to remove bullets, We remove bullets if they're having problems with the bullets. Bullets rarely migrate. They don't travel in the human body. They usually get encapsulated in a thick scar that prevents them from moving. And interestingly, there's probably over 300,000 Vietnam veterans that still have their shrapnel bullets left from Vietnam. So we know that they don't move around. But we remove bullets if people ask us to do it. For example, if it's under your belt line or if it's on your shoulder or if it's underneath where you put your pen every day and it's causing you a problem, most physicians and surgeons are glad to remove that. But most bullets are really left in the human body. They cause no problems. Again, it goes back to the old saying of firstly, do no harm.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. William Schwab and Therese Richmond co-founded the Firearm Injury Center at Penn.